ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom.
Leg Effect continues here on WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Every month, astrophysicist Gene Creighton joins us to talk about astronomy and new scientific discoveries. But the process of making these discoveries can still seem a little unclear. Like, how does someone come up with a theory, and then how do they test them? Creighton joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers now to talk about the nature of science and demystify the process.
So I think it's important to start here. When we're talking about the nature of science, it feels like we're talking about science in some ways as a verb, as an action. How do you define, you know, the nature of science?
This is an interesting philosophical question in some ways, and I think we need to talk more about the nature of science so that we understand when people talk about various things, we understand where they're coming from and what it means. I hear people say, oh, these scientists, I couldn't be a scientist. They dream up theories. They get an inspiration. They, like, science comes from the ether. And honestly, that's not how it works. In most cases, scientists notice something because they have more information, more context that surprises them. And I think that's the first thing that happens. That's the spark of it. And one of my favorite examples is, can I tell you a story?
Yeah.
Yeah. So the story is this, I think it's a chemist. He goes to his kid's lunch. And this is probably a middle school cafeteria, right, with all that means. And at some point in time, there's this food fight that breaks out. It's mayhem in the cafeteria, and everybody's ducking for cover. And the kids, of course, are having a wonderful time. Now, whereas most adults would probably think, how are they going to keep the ketchup off their white shirt? He notices that the ketchup behaves differently than all the other things that are getting tossed around. And because he has some context, this stops him in his tracks and realizes, whoa, there's something really special about this ketchup. And he starts analyzing the crystalline kind of the textures of the various proteins in the ketchup. And eventually this guy is part of a Nobel Prize in chemistry because he noticed something that a whole lot of people were seeing, but they didn't know that this is weird. So a question or something that's surprising is the first step. And then, obviously, this could have been noticed by somebody else. The next step is, well, maybe somebody's answered this before. Maybe this is a question that, you know, we have the answer to. So you do a background search. You look and see on the web, in libraries. You talk to friends. You know, I noticed this. Have you noticed this? And that kind of gets the conversation going. Now, if it's been solved, you think, oh, okay, well, I just got hit on something that other people hit on. Okay, fine, lovely. But often, it's something that nobody's noticed before or not the way that you did. So now you start having ideas of, oh, I wonder why that is. And it's pretty natural to have a first instinct, a gut response to that, which could be completely nonsense, but you do have one. And so this is not scientific, but for example, I'm sitting in my kitchen and I notice that the two cars of our neighbors are both gone and it's first thing in the morning. This is a very unusual pattern. And I already have a theory in my mind, and I'm using the term theory here loosely, but an idea. Oh, it's a 3-day weekend. Maybe they're on vacation. This hypothesis, is that's what that would be scientifically speaking, in science speak, might be wrong, might be right. However, if my hypothesis is correct, then I make a prediction. If they're on vacation, then I bet those cars are going to be absent tomorrow morning very early as well. And the next day, I see that both cars are again missing. That doesn't prove my hypothesis, but it strengthens it. If one of those cars or both of those cars was there, then it categorically rejects my hypothesis. Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. I think we all have that experience, right?
Yeah.
In our daily lives, we go, oh, this happened. I bet this is why. And sometimes it is why, and sometimes it's not.
Right. And I think we behave like scientists more often than we acknowledge. So you make a prediction, and as a scientist, you're looking for ways to test that prediction. And in the universe, we don't, it's not like a chemistry lab where I can say, oh, I can try this experiment, I can control parameters. Sadly, the universe is what it is, and you get what you get. There are ways of tweaking some things, but you don't have the same freedom as you would in the lab. You make your observations and either ding, 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 yes, that strengthens your hypothesis, or no, that's wrong. If it's wrong, you double check the data just in case, because sometimes the data is flawed or there's some systematic errors. But, you know, your windows weren't clean and yes, the part of the car is gone. Or no, it's there, but your windows are so dirty you can't see them. Hopefully that's not the case. But you clean up your data. You do what you need to do. And then you say, okay, nope, that really, my prediction is wrong. Therefore, I need to either completely throw away my hypothesis or modify it. Or I actually see that my prediction came true, and now I am thinking that I should look for more predictions to strengthen my hypothesis further.
What does that look like, looking for more predictions?
Einstein is an excellent example. So Einstein had several predictions from his general theory of relativity. And, you know, I don't want to go into detail about all these things, but one had to do with the motion of Mercury. One had to do what would happen during a solar eclipse. He had a bunch of them. And we were checking off one and another and another and another. And as you got more of this data, you thought, okay, well, everything is checking out. That makes his theory very strong. So his general relativity theory is one of the most tested theories that we have.
Is that because there are so many predictions inside of that theory?
Yes, which makes a wonderful theory. That makes for good science. The more predictions you have that can be tested, the stronger your theory is, because that means that you help us look for things. And when we find them, it's like, yay. You can't prove it, but you can strengthen it.
What happens when some of these predictions aren't right? Say you have a theory and you have, you know, 12 different predictions that come out of it, and you can prove about 6 of them, but the other 6 are looking a little questionable.
It depends on how questionable. It only takes one. It only takes one prediction that's wrong, and at the very least needs to be, the theory will need to be tweaked. If something has passed multiple tests, you usually can't just throw it away because so much of it is predicted. But as I said, in principle, you only need one thing that's not, you're not predicting correctly. And then we know, oh, no, we need to change something.
So the theory needs to be revised in some way.
Revised in some way. And it could be that it's some small little tweak, but in some cases it's like, yeah, Aristotle had this idea that we were in the center of the whole universe, but it just took one piece of evidence to say, nope, all of that's gone. The whole notion that we're at the center of the universe is history. Now, after you make your predictions, you analyze your data, you look at it, then you communicate it. And this is an important piece that people, I don't think, always appreciate. If I sat home and made beautiful theories, which I made wonderful predictions from, that all came true, and I never told anybody, this would be a real waste of time, and that information, that wisdom would get lost. So you tell your friends, you publicize in journals, and the nice thing about that is if it's a good journal, it will be peer-reviewed. Because quite frankly, we tend to want our gut instincts to come true. So you need somebody who's not invested to say, oh, I see your line of evidence. I see the predictions you made. Yes, here's the data. Yes, yes, yes. Yes, I'm with you. I agree. Or here is a piece that you could say that would make your case even stronger. Or, this looks a little weak. How about you talk about that? What are the limitations of your data? Convincing other scientists, especially scientists who do not share your opinion, is a great way of strengthening your argument.
So when we hear about theories, the general public, not, you know, the general public like myself, who are perhaps not physicists or scientists, have these theories gone through all of these steps in general?
Yeah. Yeah. It is useful to know, in my line of business in astronomy, usually there's not a whole lot of interests at heart. It's not like, oh, I hold a ticket to one of the most valuable pharmaceutical formulas that could change the life and could make lots of people millionaires. Then there's interest that you need to think about. Whose interests am I protecting, right?
Follow the money, as it were.
Yeah. So some scientists are a little more prone to that. So you need to watch more closely than say, you know, what is the mechanism that drives magnetic fields on Jupiter? These are very interesting scientific questions, but probably not billions of dollars to be made by that. So you see, the standard has to be different depending on who gains from this information.
Yeah.
So the general public needs to ask those questions. Is your opinion guided by any kind of interest?
Why do you believe it's important for people to understand the nature of science?
Well, first of all, I think because we're all scientists, and I think it's useful for people to realize, hey, I see things that surprise me. I make some hypothesis, let's use a technical term, or I have an idea how to fix this. I mean, in everyday life, we should celebrate our own kind of ability to solve problems because that's really what science is. And as you look at newspapers, you hear on the radio, you look on television at things that we learn about topics that we're not experts in, you can kind of follow a little more closely if you understand in principle how this works. So I'm hoping to give some of those tools to our listeners.
Yeah. Well, Jean Creighton, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Thank you so much, Joy. This was a joy. This was a joy. Can I say it?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Lake Effect contributor Jean Creighton is the director of the Manfred Olson Planetarium, located on the campus of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, and you can explore more of our astronomy conversations with Dr. Creighton at wuwm.com.